This episode of Linux Action Show is brought to you by GoDaddy.com.
And by Ting.com. Head over to last.ting.com and save $25 off your first device.
Welcome to Linux Action Show, Season 30, Episode 6. My name is Chris.
My name is Matt.
Good morning to you, Matt. Are you ready for me to transfer what the big show is about today?
Oh my goodness, I've been looking forward to it all week.
I'll start up rsync right now, Matt. God, this is just getting horrible. I'm going to bail while I can. So coming up on this week's episode of the Linux Action Show, Ian Hex is going to join us. Now, Ian is a talented photographer, but here's the catch. His workflow is under Linux using open source software. And he just recently published a free tutorial on how he does some amazing HDR photos under Linux. So we're going to get him on. And I've been wanting to do this episode literally for years. But, you know, neither one of us are, like, huge photographers.
No, I'm not. I certainly am not. I can barely take pictures. Right?
Yeah, I know.
I get the camera facing the wrong way. It's a mess.
Right. And honestly, one of the things that's sort of been a barrier for me is not just the high cost of hardware, but also the high cost of software that you need to manage all of that. And to me, it's just been a non-starter. But I'm excited to chat with Ian today because I think we're going to change some of that. Plus, in the news segment, did you know that Ubuntu just recently got some high scores with the UK? China revealed their own operating system. And there's been some big developments at Steam Dev Day. Some changes are coming. We'll tell you all about those in the news segment.
Nice.
And in the feedback segment, there's some big news for you. For those of you looking for a job, maybe you want to work with OpenSUSE. We'll tell you about that.
Wow.
First, though, it is our picks, as is tradition here on the show, Matt. Our Runs Linux this week is going to control your home. That's right. It's called Ivy, I-V-E-E, and it is one part alarm clock, one part home automation system. Now, this new one's called Ivy Sleek. It's $200, and it's a home automation hub offering voice control of Wi-Fi-enabled devices with a Siri-like assistant. Ivy has a default clock, and it's also a radio. Now, this was revealed as a concept at CES a year ago. Mm-hmm. On July 21st, they ran a Kickstarter, and they quadrupled their goal of $40,000 with $160,000, roughly. Okay. The devices recently began shipping at Staples and was showcased at CES last week as a working product. And also, Staples and Lowe's announced that their smart devices will support Ivy. Now, using voice recognition system, it's based on AT&T's Watson speech APIs.
Okay.
It's going to have support for Nest thermostats, Lockitron and Goji locks, Belkin and Philips Hue smart lights, and the SmartThings automation hub. It runs Linux with a 400 megahertz ARM9 processor, 128 megabytes of RAM, 256 megabytes of flash. Now, remember, this is on the clock, you guys. It has a 4.3-inch TFT LCD display. It has Wi-Fi 802.11b and g, temperature and light sensors. It has dual-beam focusing microphones, which are said to cancel ambient noise and enable commands to be issued from up to 15 feet away.
Oh, my God.
Okay. So this thing also has a USB port, so it can charge your smartphone. Yeah. So this is the Ivy Sleek. It's going to be around $230, $200 at Staples. You want to see a demo of it, Matt? What do you think?
I want to see a demo.
Are you skeptical a little bit?
Also looks like it works with the thermostat.
Yeah. In fact, I think they'll show that right here in this here video.
Good morning.
Hello, Ivy.
I would just like to wish you a very happy birthday.
Thanks, Ivy. So what's the weather going to be like today?
The weather is a bit warmer, with a high of 86 degrees and a low of 80 degrees.
Hello, Ivy. It's a little warm in here. Can you lower the temperature?
Yes. I will lower the thermostat now.
Hello, Ivy.
How can I help you?
Can you set a reminder in 30 minutes to take this out of the oven?
Reminder is set for 30 minutes from now. There is currently an accident on PCH. I would recommend leaving 15 to 20 minutes early.
Thanks, Ivy.
In what year did the Teapot Dome scandal occur?
1922?
That's 9 out of 10 questions correct. Great job, Patrick.
I made a little mess on the kitchen floor. Can you clean that up for me, please?
No problem. I will send the vacuum. Your baking is now complete.
Happy birthday, honey.
Happy birthday, Dad.
Thanks, buddy. Now let's go make sure you're not late for that history test.
This is very Jetsons, but I also picture a darker side to this, because you know I'm going to go there. It's like, hey, Ivy, I'm a little cold. Can you warm it up for me? All the windows start locking and shutting and whatnot. It's like oven opens up, vacuum shoves you in there. You know, I mean, you know, it definitely could go south pretty quick. But it is cool that it is able to like give you traffic reports and all that.
That is nice,
stuff.
Right?
You know,
it's like Google now meets Siri meets your alarm clock. And, you know, one of the things that this Internet of Things promises is all of a bunch of incompatible standards. And what I actually like about this one is they're like, hey, you know what? We're going to work with all the different vendors. So it's a cool concept. I don't know if this is probably nothing we're going to – I mean, would you want to spend $230
on a car? Not now, but at some point it might be kind of cool. I mean, it's kind of like X10, but without all the failed promises.
Yeah.
It's able to – it seems like it's able to work amongst a variety of different devices.
Well, you've got a new generation of protocols. You've got a new generation of processors and devices and a more advanced software set. And, of course, they're powered by Linux, which is really cool.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's attractive. I mean, it doesn't look, you know, like clunky. You know?
Honestly, if like this could be tied in to do a few, if this could automate a few things for me, I'd probably.
Oh, okay. Picture this: it's like, you know, you need someone to set reminders, or maybe you got. It's like, oh yeah, I forgot to render that one thing, or you know, go do this for me. Run cron jobs or whatnot. That'd be kind of cool.
Yeah, actually, you know, that's a great example. If this could work with my computer, and my computer could send it notifications when like, hey, this file is finished encoding, and then I could get up and walk around the house, and then get notified.
Or like the new video card. Your video card is now on fire.
Yeah.
Would you like this?
It was the power supply. Okay, Matt, technically.
Would you like the sprinklers to come on? Okay.
Right. That was actually what I was worried about, is I didn't want to get us covered in water. Oh, all right, Matt. Well, before we get to our rest of our picks this week, I want to thank GoDaddy.com, sponsor of the Linux Action Show. Now, there was apparently a little behind-the-scenes snafu that I didn't know about. And, you know, sometimes Van Damme just takes care of business himself. And it turns out when he was in the data center scoring you all really cheap .coms, he felt like that wasn't enough.
Oh.
And so he went to business. And when I say Van Damme went to business, I mean he went to business of kicking some arse to get us even better deals.
Gosh.
And now you can take 30% off anything you want over at GoDaddy.com. Any new order, 30% off when you use the promo code 30DEAL8 when you're checking out over at GoDaddy. Get some hosting.
Yeah.
Get a domain. Get a couple of domains. Get yourself a cert. You know, GoDaddy has some wicked new cool WordPress hosting where they've rebuilt WordPress hosting from the ground up to be optimized and scalable and secure just for WordPress. That might be something you want to take a little money off. Maybe you want to get yourself a couple of .coms, maybe a .tv, or I'm not judging here, maybe a .am.
Hey.
You never know. Well, Van Damme is kicking some arse for you, so go over to GoDaddy.com. It is go time. And use the promo code 30DEAL8 when you check out. 30DEAL8 over at GoDaddy.com. will save you 30% on anything in your shopping cart that's new. And by the way, we also have a banner in our show notes. You can click that, and it'll pre-charge your shopping session.
Nice.
So you can get that savings. A big thank you to GoDaddy for sponsoring the Linux Action Show.
And a big thanks to Van Damme for making that happen for us. That's awesome.
You know, every now and then you just need somebody to go in there and take charge of the situmication.
That's right.
Okay, Matt. So this week I wanted to share a tool that I just think is super cool. And if you're familiar with CPU-Z on the Windows platform, this is probably going to
No, that's going to be cool.
This is called iNext. I don't know how old it is. It just recently showed up on my radar. And it is, I'd say it's even cooler than what CPU-Z does. So I'll give you a little demo. I got it installed right here. Again, it's called i-next. Mm-hmm. And here is...
Oh, dude, it's almost exactly
right.
That's awesome.
So here's all of the... So what it does is it essentially reads all of this information that's available throughout Linux, but it's not all in one spot. And it's not all displayed like this either. And so here you can see, here's my CPU info. Mm-hmm. Here's the current CPU temperature. You can see that this machine does have an integrated Intel HD4000 that isn't being used. It's the Ivy Bridge processor set. All of that's right here, right? Here's my TDP, which is really cool to see. I can also get my GPU info right here. So here's my NVIDIA card and like all the specs about the NVIDIA card right here. Here's all the information about the MOBO. You can see it's a System 76, right? Here's the stuff about the audio subsystem. Mm-hmm. Here's information about my drives and their various capacities. Here's my system information, so you can see I'm running Arch Linux. You can see what version of GLX I have.
I love how it gives you a badge, too. That's awesome.
Yeah, each distro gets a badge. Here's the kernel information, so you can see which kernel I'm running. Memory information, so you can pull all the... You can see here's my individual RAM sticks. Here's the total use. Mm-hmm. Here's currently used. This is a really cool... Here's networking stats. Okay, so this is all really great, right? But one of the other things this can do, and this could be really handy, is you can generate a report. Yes. And when you generate this report, you can say what aspects of that screen you want to include. And then what's really nice is you can have it automatically send that report if you want to like Pastebin or Slexi, for example. So I have that loaded up somewhere on my machine here. Let me see. Oh, yeah, here. So you can see here it generated this report and then sent it to the Slexi Pastebin site for me. And so if I was troubleshooting with somebody or whatever, I could send this to them. Here's all my individual processor information, right?
So and I can look for anything that stands out.
You can see here's my NVIDIA stuff. Tells you that I'm on NVIDIA driver 331.38. Again, really good for troubleshooting, right?
Very good. I mean, that's excellent because it's like something you might overlook, someone else may be able to help you with, but it's providing in a format that isn't just making making it painful.
Right, and it's a great list of all this, and you can save this.
Oh man!
So if you're doing inventory on computers in your organization and things like that, this will grab that for you. It's a nice, easy way to collect all of that, especially if you're working with a few people. You could have it send over to Pastebin, and then they could download it from Pastebin and save it right to the inventory. So yeah, it's called iNEX, and it's a lot like CPU-Z, but maybe even a little better. And of course, it's built for Linux. Now it is available. I think I saw it over on software.opensuse.org, and it is in the Arch repo.
Cool.
On GNOME apps. I think I also saw downloads in Debs and maybe a Fedora RPM. But
nice.
check your local repo for it. You can also just go grab it, and I think it has a download, and you just run the binary.
Oh, okay,
so you don't
cool.
even really have to install it.
Throw it wherever you want.
Yeah. So that's a really cool tool, and I just came across it this last week, and I wanted to point people over to iNEX.
Really nice.
And it's also up on GitHub, and it's written in Python. And,
I like the hell out of that. I'm installing that when I get home, actually. That's good.
Yeah. Very good. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes. Now, Matt, there is one more pick. Usually this is a software one when we do the spotlight, but this week I wanted to spotlight a really cool initiative that's going on right now. This is from Penn Manor School District, and it's for their high school students. After a two-day setup and a marathon of 1,725 laptops are now ready for distribution and delivery to Penn Manor High School students. Now, this is so cool. They took the middle school cafeteria and transformed it into a computer assembly line.
Whoa.
Using some software that the students and teachers, I think teachers, put together. Maybe it was all students. They called it the Linux Deployment Toolkit, Fast Linux Deployment Toolkit, FLDT. It's derived from several open source projects, and true to its name, it makes Linux software setup fast and easy. Andrew's program rapidly copies our custom Ubuntu image from one master laptop to as many as 50 laptops at a time. The entire FLDT copy process completes in less than 2 minutes and accelerates the process of cloning software to hundreds of laptops. And they're making it available on GitHub for other schools that might want to use that.
Dude, that's awesome.
They had did nearly 24 hours of work with a 13 to 20 person crew, and then the laptops were shipped to Penn Manor High School. And here's a look at this animated GIF. So they converted the cafeteria. You can see the juice machines here.
Right,
in the back.
Right, yep.
And they have them all hooked up here to networking, and then they deployed them. And check out, they even have the image isn't loading. They have their own light DM theme for the high school. You can kind of see it in the screenshot a little bit,
but
yeah, the images.
You got some pictures of the laptops themselves, and then just different angles of the room.
With
laptops and boxes. It looks like okay, so actually the boxed laptops.
Yeah, and then they just sit there and they deploy the image to them, and then they ship them off to the high school students.
There's a really good picture. Actually. Yeah, that
there you go. So there you can see. So they have the school logo there on the login screen. Isn't that great?
That is like, I mean, that's school pride right there.
It's really cool
to have your own school operating system, basically.
And it's really exciting to see this kind of stuff. And I think, we are going to see more and more of this, right? We're going to see more students doing it, more schools doing this kind of thing, because it makes a lot of sense from a budget standpoint, from a support standpoint, from a lock-in standpoint.
I can't even fathom having, like, laptops in school as a kid. That must be so cool.
Oh, man.
Of course, I wouldn't get anything done.
Oh, man.
I'd be screwing around the whole time. But, yeah, I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, good times.
Yeah. Excellent. So go check that out. We'll have a link if you guys want to see that in the show notes. It's a good read up, and congratulations to them. That sounds like an awesome initiative. All right, Matt, let's do the news.
Hey, it's the news, and this episode is brought to you by
Ting.com. Matt, Ting is mobile that makes sense, a no BS mobile service provider. My mobile service provider and Matt's mobile service provider.
Yish.
I love that note too, man. I love this Nexus 5. I think we both have some really great picks from the Ting network. Now, both of these, definitely. We own these phones outright, and there are no contracts and no early termination fees. Ting really is redoing the way mobile works. And one of the reasons for that is because Ting is an MVNO. So if you have good Sprint service in your area, you're going to have great Ting service in your area. And because of that, Ting is focusing on the customer, the devices, and the end user experience. And as to such, here's a great example of that. When you call Ting at 1-855-TING-FTW anytime between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern, a real person just picks up. Oftentimes on the first ring, and they can solve your problem, and they're empowered to see it all the way through to the end. They can focus on customer service like that, and that's what makes Ting different. And they're also changing the way billing is done in the mobile industry. Ting is pay for what you use. No contract, no early termination fee. They just take your messages, your minutes, and your megabytes, and they add them up at the end of the month. Whatever bucket you fall into, that's what you end up paying. And of course, every Ting plan includes voicemail, caller ID, messaging, hotspot, and tethering are included. Also, to help you transition over to Ting, so that way you can get into this better setup, Ting has an early termination relief program. You can go to ting.com/ETF. There, you can get a little more information about their ETF program, but it's super simple. Here's how it works. You grab your device, you port your number, and then you submit your claim to Ting, and they'll refund you up to $75 per device. Think about that.
That's big stuff.
That makes moving over to Ting a lot easier, and if you want to get an idea of the whole picture, go over to last.ting.com. Click on that savings calculator. Put in your current bill. See how much you're going to save per month. Then factor in that ETF and factor in the fact that there's never going to be an early termination fee for Ting and that you own your device outright, which gives it a long-term value, much longer than just a standard contract. And you can really see how Ting is going to save you money.
Right.
So go to last.ting.com. That'll take $25 off your first device. If you already have a Sprint-compatible device, go check out their BYOD page. And you can save $25 on your first month. Now, if your usage is about equivalent to mine, my first month, that was free. $25 paid for my entire first month, which is really awesome. Ting has a lot of great phones from the brand new Galaxy Note 3, HTC One. They support the Nexus 5. They also have some feature phones that are under $100. When you go to last.ting.com, you can get the Samsung M400 for $73. That's off contract. You own it outright, no early termination fee, and you only pay for what you use.
Nice.
It's super nice. So go get started. Go to last.ting.com. And a huge thank you to Ting for sponsoring the Linux Action Show. I've been using them for over a year. Totally love them. I really recommend you guys go check them out. We got people in our chat room who are saving money right now because they switched to Ting.
Oh, we got people switching every day. It's great.
It is really great. So thank you to Ting. We love your sponsorship, and we love your service.
That's right.
I think this is one of the best phones I've ever had, this Nexus 5. I'll tell you why, too. I love the HTC One, but I've been developing a camera problem.
Oh, have you?
Yeah.
So it's kind of pulled you back into the Nexus.
And I got a wireless charger for my Nexus 5, which feels like the freaking future. It heats it up a little bit more than
I'd like, and
it's slower to charge. But the fact that I just like sit down at my desk and I'm like, plop, and it's like,
that's cool.
It's like I'm in Star Trek a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Well, you get a little Jetsons music going on in the background, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Yeah. Elroy comes running by.
So this was almost the Runs Linux this week. But I decided to make it a news item. In Linux Unplugged, for a couple of episodes now, we've been covering this big decision that Debian's making about the future of their init system.
Boy.
Now, don't go to sleep yet. We're talking about an init system.
It's like, what?
But it has huge ramifications because Debian's trying to pick between things like OpenRC, Systemd, and Upstart from Ubuntu. And the implications here for the wider Linux ecosystem are pretty big because if Debian goes with Systemd, then pretty much all of Linux will be standardizing on Systemd with a few big exceptions like Ubuntu.
Yeah.
And so this has been something that people have been watching really closely as the Debian technical committee is getting closer and closer to making a decision. It now seems like the tide is turning towards Systemd.
I think so.
I'll talk about that here in a sec. But first, I want to read this. This was sent into the Debian mailing list where they're discussing this.
Mm-hmm.
By somebody at Spotify.
Oh, that's kind of a big deal.
Spotify runs Linux, yeah. So he wrote in, and this is one of their back-end guys. He says, Spotify is a significant user of Debian, GNU/Linux. We have some 5,000 physical servers and well over 1,000 virtual servers using both public and private clouds running Debian GNU Linux, serving millions of songs to our users every day.
Wow.
Now, I figured Spotify used Linux.
You kind of gathered that, right? Yeah.
But it sounds like it's critical to the Spotify infrastructure. 5,000 Debian servers?
Yeah. So they kind of have a vested interest, just a tiny bit?
Yeah. He goes on to say, we'd like to take this opportunity to endorse Systemd as our preferred init system, and we would like to see it as default on Debian GNU Linux moving forward. And he goes on to talk about how the dependency model of Systemd is easier to understand. He talks about various features built on top of Systemd, that Systemd is built on top of, I mean, like C groups, which are great for server setting resource limitations and things like that. And he also believes that Systemd will have a stronger community momentum moving forward.
Yeah.
And so he threw in, now this isn't likely to sway.
No, but it's a really balanced, fair, logical argument for, you know, pro Systemd, I think.
And Don Armstrong, who's been a Debian developer since 2004, so pretty much forever, he also weighed in. Now this isn't a vote per se, but this is him mailing to the mailing list saying, I also want to go with Systemd. And Servazella on Reddit summed it all up. Now, these aren't votes. These are just technical committee members who have
kind of thrown out their opinions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we have 3 for Upstart, and it looks like at this point we have 4 for Systemd
Interesting.
Yeah. So it and one that hasn't voted yet, Andreas. So just something we're going to be monitoring. We'll probably follow up more on Linux Unplugged in the future. But big changes are afoot to Debian. And one of the reasons why I think this is important on a bigger picture is, and this is something I want to address soon.
Yeah.
Is with more people switching over to Linux because of Steam, there is a lot of Windows bias out there.
Oh, man.
And people are really harping on the fragmentation aspect of Linux. Kind of, I think Android brought it into the general...
Android brought it to the public knowledge, but I think that's always been the underlying thing with the Windows power users.
Right. You know? And systemd goes a long way in sort of unifying some of the underpinnings of Linux, and will more so in the future, even more so than it does now. And so it is a huge part of combating that common criticism, not to mention also just unifying and adding some features that pretty much every commercial operating system has always had.
Well, and I think a lot of it, too, is that back in the day, they used to say, well, you know, Linux is real scripty in the back end. It's it's run by rubber bands and bash scripts and stuff and that sort of thing. And it's like, that's no longer the case. It's gotten to a point where it is becoming more unified in key areas and remaining free where it needs to.
And I think that's key. And I think that's why systemd is important. And I think if Debian switches to systemd and you have all these other distros switching to systemd, we sort of normalize some of that.
That's right.
And I got another point we'll catch when we get to Steam Dev Days. But first, I want to give a tip of the hat to Ubuntu, who scored the highest in UK government security assessment. Now, this is an interesting thing. This government security assessment was a report that was published recently. It compared 11 desktops and mobile operating systems across 12 categories, including VPN, disk encryption, and authentication. What I think is sort of what they're looking at here is it's a larger picture of security audit. So it's not just about patches. It's not just about defaults. It's about long-term support. It's about managing it, and it's about solutions available to address shortcomings. And at the end of it, they shook it all out and said, Ubuntu 12.04 LTS came out on top when compared to other operating systems, and it passed all 9 requirements without any significant risks. Now, why is this important? These types of reports are sort of the baseline that a lot of government institutions will use before they can accept an operating system for deployment.
That's true.
So it doesn't really mean a lot to you or I necessarily, but it does mean a lot to existing government departments who want to deploy Ubuntu Linux. This is going to kind of give them the green light, at least in the security
aspect.
That's
right. Right.
So this is a big deal for them, and congratulations.
Yeah,
and you can read the full report. Now, I remind, they're not saying it's the most secure operating system in the world.
It meets some critical criteria.
Yeah, and that's what they're saying. And that's a great thing.
Good stuff.
A new operating system's on the scene from China, and it's called COS. Yeah, COS. It's a government-approved operating system designed to break the monopoly of foreign software, as they say.
Government-approved. I love that.
Yeah. It came from a company called Shanghai Lingtong, and I'm not quite sure.
Okay.
And they've joined forces with the Institute of Software and Chinese Academy of Sciences. And they're launching COS, which simply stands for China Operating System. It also appears that HTC is a big supporter behind this project, which would match what Engadget also heard from a Wall Street Journal report in August. The Linux-based OS is said to be developed entirely independently in hopes of breaking foreign software monopolies, as well as providing better localizations for the likes of language input, cloud service, and, of course, monetization.
Okay, so back that up. It's being developed completely independently. So they've taken that whole Linux kernel thing, just tossed that aside, and they just whipped one up overnight.
Not only do I not buy that.
This is like North Korea Linux. I mean, this is like, really? I mean, this is literally is what it sounds like. I mean, it's like, come on. I'm serious. I mean, it's a cool idea until they said that, and then they kind of lost me.
Yeah.
That really bummed me out.
So Engadget contacted HTC to see what they would say about this, and HTC's response was, HTC remains focused on working with its current OS partners, and we do not have comment or speculation regarding other OSs.
In other words, that's PR speak for we're not getting in the middle of this peeing contest.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So here is, Engadget has a video of the UI. And when I look at this UI video, what I see, well, hold on. First,
I was
going to
say,
like,
wow, that is really cool. It's like,
it's got like all this motivational, like 5,000 years. Man has struggled
to build an OS,
built the Great Wall. Right? But then if you move forward here and actually see it in use, these are Android devices.
Yeah.
That looks like Android to me, Matt.
It is Android.
That is totally Android.
But I mean, maybe they, you know.
Although it has cool sound effects.
It does. Yeah, they added some WAV files.
That's an HTC One. That's an HTC One phone, right?
Oh, my God.
So, I'm thinking.
Basically, what they did is they took Android and slapped some spyware on it and called it a new OS, and, you know. Or more spyware. I don't know. Whatever.
Well, I mean, look, you can't blame him in a post-Snowden world.
No, and I think that's fine. I think it's – no, I would agree with them taking an existing kernel and, you know, doing as much auditing as they feel comfortable with and doing all the things they need to do to feel safe and secure with
right.
it, then load it up with their own spyware so that China feels more secure with it.
Right.
But
their own brand
of spying. Yeah, because any government – I don't care which government
it
is.
So I guess what you're taking umbrage with is the fact that they're calling it totally independent.
That's what bugs me. I mean, because I like the idea up until they're like, oh, hey, we just did all this ourselves. No credit goes to anybody. Blah blah blah, that's crap. You know.
Hey man, as long as they contribute code, I'll give them a pass.
Yeah,
but I agree
that's
with
fine.
You.
I guess. Mm-hmm. It's just too bad because it was a great opportunity if it was like developed for the people by the people. That's cool.
Yeah.
This doesn't seem to be the case.
No.
This definitely seems to be the case. It's just an opportunity to further, you know, Great Wall of China, cap everybody. So.
And I think you know,
boy,
it might be hard from our perspective because I think there's a deep distrust that they have with software that comes from here, especially. When companies that are behind the software have close relationships with the United States government, I can understand the reluctance there. And you know,
and I totally get it. And like I said, audit, do what you got to do, but give credit where credit's due. That's all I'm asking. Then do whatever you need to do. That's fine.
I hear you. Well, let's talk about some potentially good news. The Delhi government or Delhi government is about to announce the switch to free software. And this is after they've had a productive chat with Mr. Richard Stallman. Now, the details on this are pretty rough because it just broke this morning and this is a Sunday, so people haven't really dug into it. But the Delhi government is set to opt for free software. Here's a little clip of Richard Stallman. Wait for it. Here it comes in 1 second. And go.
It's just the general idea that the state and especially schools should move to free software.
And that's the only thing in English in the whole report.
Oh, wow, because I was going to say, dude, he really, his Punjabi's improved.
Actually,
it sounds like he really was just nailing down that syllable.
To his credit, I have seen a few videos with RMS when he's in another country, and he'll just slip into, I don't know how many languages he speaks, but I've heard him speak a couple of different languages.
Because initially I thought it was him, and it's like, he's very fluent. I was impressed. Yeah. I was like, wow, okay.
So the former IT advisor, the chief minister, said before that he was shunted and failed to deploy it, but now they have new political movement behind it, and they invited RMS out to speak about the advantages of it. So I think we'll be hearing more about this.
Cool.
I wanted to slip this in right here because this could be a huge story that develops for the week, or it could be nothing big. But I wanted to give it a chance here.
Yeah,
on the show.
No, I think it's interesting. I think the fact that he's actually got that kind of pull there and that much interest is a big deal.
Is he always wearing that red shirt?
He is.
It's like his jobs. He's got like a uniform.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if it's a uniform, political statement, or he just really digs red. Maybe brings out his cheeks. I don't know.
Yeah. Brings out his beard.
Brings out his beard. Got his pops. You
know? So I wanted to go to Steam Dev Days so bad this week. It just, first of all, I'm not making any games. Second of all, I totally forgot about it.
Yeah,
and then, apparently Gabe's not returning my calls. I don't understand what's going on there. But we did have Steam Dev Days, and I'm just going to give you a couple of highlights. I won't spend too much time on this.
Mm-hmm.
But about 600 to 700 developers came to the Seattle area where Valve announced they are indeed hiring. They want to add things like music, TV, and more to SteamOS. So we're going to get some video streaming stuff.
Wow.
Alienware said that their machine will launch in September.
Oh, okay.
The new controller with the touch screen with the touch
touch pads.
Yeah. And the screen. They're taking out the screen. They're removing the screen. It's going to have a D-pad and ABXY buttons for backwards compatibility. But that screen we saw and these buttons along the sides are gone. The buttons are going to be clustered at the bottom, and there's just going to be kind of a blank space in the middle of the controller. A couple of things. They said the screen was too distracting, but
yes, I agree with that.
I think also it's really about cost.
Oh, yeah, because then it's less components, less cost, less stuff.
Right, and maybe these Steam Machine partners were like, look, Gabe, buddy, we want to ship your Steam Machine. We want to ship the Gabe Box, the GameCube, so bad.
It's like, have you seen other controllers? They don't have all this crap.
Yeah, your controller is $150 of our cost right here. We need to get that down. If we're, how are they, is Valve selling them the controllers? Like, how is that working?
Well, and it also opens up the opportunity for an upsell later on, like where you have the deluxe controllers for consoles to buy separately. They can always come back and revisit this.
Good point. And it probably takes less battery. In fact, they said it's also going to just take like a AA battery now. The Steam Controller API will support up to 16 players.
Heard some of the other consoles, they literally just USB directly into your bank account.
Yeah.
And it just drains it dry as you're buying these games. So with Valve, you don't have this problem.
Valve says that they've been working with virtual reality, and they plan to work with Oculus Rift some more to support that.
They now have
75 million active Steam users. Oh, here's a picture of the...
That, I think, is actually really good.
So you have your standard buttons there. It's a little empty right there.
It's a little empty. It looks a little bit like a sad face, but I'm okay with that.
It is a little sad.
It's a little emo,
yeah,
but I'm okay.
Emo.
I'm all right with it.
So that came out of Steam Dev Days. That was just day one. Cool. Something else that was really cool is Iculus, who's been a Linux game developer for many a year, who is often hired to port games to Linux. He held a Steam Dev Days talk. And at the talk, he talked about moving over to OpenGL, moving from Windows to Linux, and things like that. And he talked about a few good points on here. It was a really, really good presentation. So I want to link to it in the show notes. You guys can watch the whole thing because he really gets into it. But one of the things he talks about is he debunks distro fragmentation. So he's been doing this for about 15 years.
So he knows what he's saying.
Yeah, he knows what he's talking about. And so here's his arguments to port your game to Linux. He says it's a new and unsaturated and underserved market. Yep. It isn't flooded with cheap crap product like Windows is. It has a low barrier to entry. There's no walled garden. And Steam and SteamOS machines are going to be moving more and more sales. That's why people are at the conference. So he did some myth bustings. He says the truth about distro fragmentation. I've shipped dozens of games over 15 years. Never did anything but a generic Linux build for any game of my games. SDL handles most of the differences for you, and the rest is largely avoidable and unimportant anyhow. Since most drivers live in the Linux kernel tree and continue to be maintained, whereas old hardware that had a Windows 95 driver never got updated to XP and later, one could argue Linux supports more hardware than Windows at this point collectively. More to the point, most things you buy off the shelf tend to just work on Linux now, which is not true when you tried it years ago. NVIDIA and AMD now ship their own GPU drivers, and there's also open source ones as well. All of them are somewhere between pretty functional and world class, and Linux users consistently spend more per capita than Mac users do, and Windows users across, just look at the Humble Bundle promotions, he says. He says, also cool disruptive tech like the Oculus Rift, Leap Motion Controller are shipping Linux SDKs. And then it goes on to talk more about middleware options and things like
really
that.
Really good stuff. And I think he really nailed it with the backwards compatibility of the hardware. I've been arguing that for years, and I've experienced it firsthand where, you know, a new computer is purchased that has Windows on it. You go to plug in something that's maybe 3-4 years old because not everybody needs to upgrade their printer every time they buy a new computer.
Right.
And it's like, oh, not going to work. Maybe I can get it to work with an older driver and kind of hack it together. Forget that. Linux, it just works. Everything, even backwards and forwards, it works really, really well.
It's nice.
It is.
One last bit of information, which is going to help a lot for people moving over to Linux, the developers are at least. Valve also announced that they're going to release a VOGL debugger for Linux. It'll be completely open source, and they welcome contributions to the tool. It's aimed for Linux game developers. It was announced at the Steam Dev Days conference. And it's a lot of people are excited about it because one of the things that's apparently pretty crappy right now is doing a lot of GL debugging. So this is going to solve that. The fact that it's open source and they're actively asking for contributions is a good sign.
I think once they get that released, that's when you're really going to see people saying, oh, doing a double take and saying, oh, yeah. Now I'm really doing it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
So there you go. There's your Steam update. Mm-hmm. Pretty compressed.
Very compressed.
So that way, for those of you who don't like the Steam news,
we tarb all your news for you.
Yeah, we did. We even did a little ran it through GZ for you.
Right.
How about that? All right, Matt, that's all the news for this week. I've been looking forward to talking about photography on this show for years and years. Ian Hex is about to join us, but before we get to that, I want to thank our segment sponsor, System 76, creators of machines that are born to run Linux. Now, look, if you want to just get up and running, you don't have to fight with hardware, I really would recommend you go check out system76.com. I'm currently on the fence. I've been doing more movie nights with the kids, and so the Ultra Pro is seeming really, really, it's calling my name. But at the same time, I just recently had a machine fire, and I could take the really high-end video card that I have, drop it in this Retel Performance, which comes with an integrated card, or you can get an external discrete GPU if you want. But I'm thinking I grab this guy. It starts at a crazy great price. I get a fourth generation i7 processor in there with Haswell. I can put it with a ton of RAM. Throw in my 780 GTX in there. Bob's your uncle. I got a brand new ultra-quiet Linux powerhouse. System 76 makes tons of great desktops and laptops, so go check them out, system76.com. Stop fighting with your Linux and enjoy your Linux.
That's right.
Trust me, it makes life a lot better. And a big thank you to System 76 for sponsoring the Linux Action Show. All right, Matt. Well, I'm really happy to welcome Ian Hex to the show. Ian, welcome to the Linux Action Show.
Thank you very much, guys.
Absolutely. Now, Ian, I want to point everybody right off the top to lightsweep.co.uk. That's your website. Also, your photos, beautiful photos. People can find them over on Smug Mug, which is lightsweep.smugmug.com. And we'll have links to those in the show notes. But, you know, Ian, I initially saw some of your photos on Google Plus, and you really matched like my eye, like this kind of stuff I really love. And I made the erroneous assumption, he must just be using Adobe Lightroom.
Yeah, yeah.
He's using proprietary software. And then I saw you announce your free HDR tutorial over at lightsweep.co.uk. And I thought, what? And I read through this, and lo and behold, Ian, you're using Linux. You're using open source software for your entire workflow, right?
Correct.
Now, how has that been, and why did you choose that? Were you a Linux user to begin with, or were you a photographer who just said, look, I need to save some money, or how did that start?
Well, essentially, before I sort of got into the photography, I was, in terms of like my visual creative pursuits, I was actually doing like logo and branding design, and I was using Linux tools for that. So I'd already been using Linux and specifically Ubuntu for a very, very long time. And then when I did sort of get myself a camera, because I've always been, you know, a nature lover and so forth, and I eventually got the opportunity to get myself a DSLR, you know, I was already using, so I just had a look around for Linux tools, and Google Plus got me into the whole HDR thing, and it really went from there.
Yeah, nice. Google Plus seems like a great medium for displaying images, mm-hmm. because, you know, they display those big high resolution images, and how I came across you was actually, I think somebody at System 76
yes.
had reshared one of your posts, and I saw that, and I had to go through your whole feed, mm-hmm. and I was really impressed. And one of the tools that you pointed folks to, I had never heard of, and I think it's a major area of shame on my part. It seems completely underappreciated. It's called Luminance HDR, and it does something that I expected was only possible with really high-grade commercial software. Could you tell our audience about Luminance HDR?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, basically, I make landscape photography and architecture photography using HDR software. Now, most people who use software to make HDR photos, which is where you take photographs of different exposure levels and then merge them together using software, most people will use what's called Photomatics, which is something that you get on Windows and Mac.
Yeah.
There's really not a lot of software out there for automated HDR work, but I did learn of Luminance HDR. I think it's gone under older names beforehand, but, you know, these days, that's the name. And I use Luminance to produce my HDR photos. And it's not quite as easy, sort of user-friendly as Photomatics. But, if you have a read of my tutorial, there are a lot of sort of bits in the software you can happily ignore and just get down to the nitty-gritty, and it can produce some incredible results.
Yeah, it has a lot of nice features that make it approachable for a user like me, like auto-aligning the images.
Oh, big time.
Right? That's actually one of the ways I was really able to wrap my brain around this is in your tutorial, you include three raw images that are at three different exposure brackets. Am I saying that right?
You got it.
Yeah. And then you bring those into Luminance HDR. You say, here's my three images. It automatically aligns all the pixels. It takes some calculations to do that. And then you're provided with a set of presets. Now, when I first looked at this, I did not produce anything that looked good at all. It was horrible. But then I went back through. I read your tutorial kind of more step by step. And I actually produced a pretty good-looking HDR image. It wasn't quite as good as yours, though. So you must be doing more than just Luminance HDR. What other tools are you using?
I think using HDR software to produce a final photo, it's not really the way forward, because HDR software can produce, you know, really nice looks in certain areas, like, you know, it's incredible for Luminance, especially if you use the Mantiuk 06 algorithm, which I think is like the normal one.
Yeah.
It's brilliant for putting out texture in rocks and wood and stuff like that. But if you do crank it up a little too much, then you can get these sort of horrible, nasty little halos in the sky and stuff like that.
Yeah, which was what I just did.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Hey, it looks like a really cool pastel.
Yeah, it does. It looks like I hand-painted that.
And you just go with that. That's cool.
What I do is I make two or three different versions of sort of two or three different HDR versions using Luminance HDR. Mm. Or three different versions. Then I go back into Darktable, and I'll take one of the RAWs and try to make it as HDR-esque as possible using just the RAW. Especially Darktable 1.4, it's now got this new masks feature, mm-hmm. which essentially means you get to draw on your RAW any of Darktable's effects that you want. So I usually use like a paintbrush and just draw.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
This is really cool. How critical is Darktable to your workflow? Because to me, it seems like one of the unsung photography heroes of open source software.
I wouldn't be able to do it without it. Simple as that.
Really?
I mean, I've used other Linux RAW managers and processors. There's one that fairly recently became open source. I think it was called LightZone.
Mm-hmm. I remember that. Mm-hmm.
I've used it a bit. It's okay. It doesn't have anywhere near as many sort of powerful modules that Darktable has. I know some people use something called RAW Therapy, but I've never used that myself. But yeah, Darktable for managing all of my RAWs, because I've got, I think, about 9,000 photos in my library at the moment.
Wow.
Goodness.
Yeah, I've only been shooting about sort of 2 years, so 9,000 images, quite a lot.
Yeah.
Yes.
For managing all my RAWs and then just being able to block one out and, process it, especially with the new masks feature, processing it essentially exactly how I want, it's just incredible. It really is.
Now, one other piece of software that I saw you give honorable mention to, and I wasn't quite sure when I was reading your review how you would fall down on it, because some people hate it, but it's GIMP, good old traditional GIMP. Mm-hmm. One of the things that people kind of complain about is it's not full, it doesn't have a full color depth range. Like, I think it's limited to 16-bit. I can't remember exactly.
I think it's 16.
Yeah. Do you have any comments on GIMP as a tool? Do you use that quite frequently, or is it something you kind of avoid?
GIMP is crucial to my workflow. It is, at the moment, limited to RGB 8-bit color depth. But GIMP at the moment is, there's a sort of version 3, I think. Yeah, version 3 is currently developed, which has a completely new backend made possible by using Geggle or GEGL software. And once everything's been ported over to GEGL, then GIMP will be able to run in 16 or even 32-bit floating point mode.
Oh, that's going to be huge.
Yeah, that'll be massive. Because Darktable can sort of modify 32-bit images as well.
Right.
So, I mean, at the moment, I think because a lot of my processing on my photos is done in Darktable and Luminance HDR, and that's 16 or 32-bit, mm-hmm. once I've blended them together into GIMP, then I don't really do too much in GIMP. I just, do a few fixes, a bit of, spot cleaning, make sure that all my color corrections are fine and my contrast is good. And then that's really it. So I'm not really sort of pushing the limit of the 8-bit color space.
Okay. So by minimizing GIMP usage and utilizing these other tools primarily, that allows you to get the effect you want without basically confronting with any potential GIMP shortcomings.
You really do have to sort of push your images quite hard before mm-hmm. you start banding and noise.
Well, so this has all been pretty positive. And one of the things that I wanted to kind of have a frank discussion about is perhaps any limitations that you run into. Like, sometimes do you find yourself pining for proprietary commercial solutions? Is there certain things you just can't get done under Linux?
Really, it's what I would love to see GIMP develop something similar that Photoshop has is, for example, if there is a certain effect that you normally do to your photos in Photoshop and it involves a whole different type of filters and so forth, you can then, for future use, you can record that as an action. And then in future, if you just want to run that same effect on a different photo, because you've recorded that work, you just press play and it automatically does it all for you. Now, GIMP doesn't really have that. I mean, obviously, you can make your own scripts and plugins and so forth. But I'm not a coder at all.
That's understandable.
Well, and I have a question regarding, like, coming from Photoshop to GIMP. One of my wife, who uses Photoshop a lot, one of the things that she complains about is that she's a keyboard shortcut kind of person, and she just can't get her head around not having those shortcuts available. I know that it's technically possible to map them to GIMP, but because the tools are slightly different, I know that can be a challenge. Is that something you've ever run into, or?
Not really, because you know, I adapt quite quickly.
Oh, okay.
Editing keyboard shortcuts in GIMP is not very hard at all.
Oh, okay.
You know, once you know the tool that you want to use, and then you know, once you use that tool and you get frustrated without having a keyboard shortcut for it, you literally just go edit keyboard shortcuts and then change it there.
Oh, okay, that makes sense. Yeah.
And we had a question from Mr. Walker on our subreddit, and he wanted to know what format do you handle long-term storage of the images? Because he doesn't want to store necessarily in proprietary RAW formats, like, you know, the Nikon RAW format. But he doesn't feel good about using PNG because you lose some of that original RAW data, and you then have no destructive editing support. So what is your long-term image storage format and strategy?
I do store everything in the RAW format provided by the camera. So in this case, because I am a Nikon camera owner, then everything is stored in .neth. Now, I know you can sort of convert them into, for example, I think Adobe have a .dsc format, but I've never really looked into that, and I don't know if it is open source or not. I imagine not.
I would actually probably be more comfortable using Nikon's format, I think.
Yeah, you would think so.
A lot of stuff's going to continue to support to open that. So we've talked about GIMP, we've talked about Darktable, we've talked about Luminance HDR. Is there any other software you use to do non-destructive processing of raw images? Or something you've tried that didn't work would also be useful.
Is there anything else I've really used? Not really, no. I mean, if you want to be sort of extremely non-destructive as possible, as it stands for the moment with Linux software, like I say, until we get GEGL fully ported into GIMP and then GIMP 3 is released, you know, we don't have a fully non-destructive workflow. But you can make in Luminance HDR, when you blend your images together, you can save 32-bit images. And if you can save them as 32-bit TIFFs or 32-bit OpenEXR images. And then all you need to do is import that back into Darktable, and Darktable can read the 32-bit image.
Okay.
And because it's in 32 bits, it's so, so pliant. And that version, that sort of way of doing HDR images produces a lot more of a natural look because no toe mapping has occurred.
Uh-huh.
It's just a 32-bit image. And then once you take it into Darktable, then you can process it like you would any RAW. So you can just turn up and down exposure or paint exposure wherever you want, increase local contrast wherever you want. So you can do an awful lot of non-destructive processing on a 32-bit image just using Luminance HDR and then Darktable.
Interesting.
That's great. So my question for you is, your tutorial was awesome, and thankfully you provided three raw images for me to play with. Now, I don't have a camera that will do the auto bracketing so I can take three exposures. Am I SOL for my HDR stuff, or could I start with a regular kind of point-and-click camera and maybe lock in exposures? Or what do you think? Do I really need to step it up if I'm going to get into HDR?
I mean, obviously, auto bracketing is desired, especially if you can sit it on a tripod, because then all you need to do is press one button and it will just clack, clack, clack. That's it, done.
Right.
But you know, my first camera was a Nikon D60, and it didn't have auto bracketing. So essentially what I did then, and, you know, some of my really popular photos were made with the D60.
Okay.
All I did was manual exposure compensation. So, for example, if you're just sort of shooting a regular scene, you're not shooting directly into the sun or anything like that, then really all you need is three exposures, and that's minus 2 EV, 0 EV, and plus 2 EV. So I would literally just set that up in camera. You know, if your camera can do aperture priority mode, all the better. You know, just set your aperture, keep your ISO as low as possible, and then manually change the exposure compensation to minus 2, click, take a shoot, then set it to minus 0, click, take a shoot, and then plus 2, click, take a shot, and then that's it. You've got your three exposures.
Okay. So I could experiment with that, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think most point-and-clicks have aperture controls and certainly ISO controls. So.
Well, you know, the last question I really had for you was about other people who are thinking about releasing their photos. I noted that you release all of these as Creative Commons, share alike non-commercial, correct? Now, what are your thoughts on using Creative Commons, and do you have any advice for people who might want to consider doing the same?
I know that sort of, you know, quote-unquote piracy is a problem for some photographers who, you know, sell their wares on the internet. I take the Troy Ratcliffe stance on this one, and if people do sort of steal your work, he calls it the price of doing business on the internet. And basically, I'm happy for there to be, you know, one or two people that might want to just download my image and print it themselves, or, you know, try to spin their image off as their own. But the thing is, because I make my images so freely findable, accessible, and downloadable, it automatically means that I'm getting more known on the internet.
Yeah, it's a great point.
Image searching tools these days are, you know, very, very sophisticated. So it's easy to trace back the root of the photo as well. I think Google has a reverse image search. There's also something called TinyEye, I believe. Mm-hmm. Yep. You can, you know, reverse image search that. So I don't mind, you know, one or two people taking my photos, because it means that thousands and thousands and thousands of people are looking at my images and, you know, reading my site and my tutorials, mm-hmm. and buying and stuff. So I'm happy for that to happen. And if it does mean that, you know, people want to download my image and use it as a wallpaper, cool, go for it. If you want to sort of take it as a base to do some more arty stuff with it, cool, do it. No worries at all.
That's awesome.
That's
well,
really cool.
Ian, great information. Thank you for getting me excited about taking photos. Is there anything else you want to touch on before we go?
I don't think so, really. It's just, you know, if, like I say, I've got my free open source, you know, tutorial on my website. Mm-hmm. It's based and does give a sort of general overview of how I do things. I do want to look into producing video tutorials, which will go much, much more in depth into, you know, very specific parts of my workflow. So if people do want to see these video tutorials be made and produced, then you've got to let me know, because then I'll do it.
Oh, I think there's probably, I mean, I would love to, right? I would love
absolutely.
To find this kind of stuff.
And I think by following your website and also maybe following you on Google Plus, that's a mm-hmm. good way to for folks to reach out to you and say, yeah, we're interested in this.
I will have a link to your Google Plus profile in the show notes. Folks can go over to lightsweep.co.uk to find the free and open source HDR tutorial that Ian has made. It's a great read. And it's really great to see somebody advocating photography under Linux, because I think there's a bit of an assumption out there that it just really can't be done. Your work is amazing,
yes,
and it's
it
a proof positive that it can be done. So thank you very much, Ian, for joining us on Linux Action Show this week.
Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of this week's broadcast. But hey, Matt, before we get out of here, I got an email from Martin I thought we'd
do. Oh, yeah?
Martin writes in on the topic of steam machines. This is a great show. Thanks very much. I just wanted to share my thought on the steam machines, and yes, I'm quite excited, just as you guys are, or at least I am. The first thing is a point I haven't heard mentioned, and it's the price of games on Steam compared to consoles. Mm. Being perhaps too cheap, I only buy Steam games on sale, which in general means that games are half price or less compared to console mm-hmm. versions. Yeah, that ain't no joke. Steam.
That's true.
Dude.
Any games I've purchased are on sale. That's my
dude,
budget.
Dude, prepare your brain for this.
Okay.
Get ready for this.
All right.
Angry Birds Star Wars 2 on the Xbox, mm-hmm. $50.
Oh, forget
I think
that.
It's free on Android.
Yeah, right?
It's crazy. And I mean, so this is the whole value of game prices isn't something I even factored into Steam machines. But long term, there's a lot of savings there. He says, also, there's the most interesting quote here. He says, When we do a 75% reduction on the game, our gross revenue is increased by a factor of 40. Not 40%, but a factor of 40. And that's at the official PlayStation magazine, where they're talking about PS4 games have to learn from Steam game prices. The second point is that even on low-end, first-generation Steam machines compete with the PS4 and Xbox One in hardware. Mm-hmm. Now, I know some people disagree with that, but I tend to. I agree with Chris that low-end Steam machines are going to beat consoles easily in performance to price in a year's time when the Broadwell chips come out. Have a great day, Martin.
That is my. That's exactly where I see it. I mean, for someone like me, that's what I'll end up getting, probably. Mm-hmm. That's what I see happening. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's about my comfort level.
Yeah, and I think when you combine the price of Steam games, the fact that you can drop a new video card in there, for some people that's going to be a good thing. Broadwell, and also what AMD's working on with Mantle and their new chips, all of that will come together in a year or so. It's really going to make a competitive offering. Plus, the consoles will be a little bit older. They're still going to be the first few years.
And it gives Steam a chance to really kind of find its, you know, kind of get all the patches applied, get everything just perfect.
I think it's going to take something really interesting to make the Steam machines break through the console noise, because the consoles in a year or so are going to be in their prime. They're going to have new game titles they don't have yet. It's going to be another year of marketing. But Steam is going to be slowly chipping away at this with the Steam machines. You're going to have Oculus Rift support come to Steam machines first.
Right.
All of this kind of premier stuff will happen there, and that'll slowly just move more and more people over. Plus, then you'll have like people building their own over time as they hear more about them, so they'll slowly and organically sort of accumulate. It's gonna be like this massive attack.
And I think it'll probably get its growth like Google did, where Google really got its growth from the geeks. I mean, because they were the ones repairing. This is my theory that Google saw most of its growth
started with the geeks.
It started with the geeks because they're the ones repairing the computers. Going, oh, you're using this search engine. No, you're going to get you something better. It's how Firefox got a lot of its growth, in my opinion. So I think the same thing could happen with Steam, to where people are thinking, oh, why are you using this? I use this, and I get these games for this price, and I'm able to do this, that, and the other thing. I think that word of mouth, even in 2014, is more important than ever. And I think that's where they're going to get their growth.
Sure. So, I agree. Or word of Twitter, as is
word of Twitter,
on this OpenSUSE Twitter feed for geeks, or as they call them, geckos, and others looking for green jobs. SUSE has almost 25 job openings at the moment.
Oh, my goodness.
25 job openings over at SUSE. So they have a link here. I'll have it in the show notes. SUSE.com/company/career something gets cut off.
Cool.
Yeah. SUSE.com/company/careers.
Be worth checking out.
That would be, if you're looking for a gerb over in there. Speaking of the internet and gerbs, Verizon's doing a job on the internet right now. They have successfully won a case that has neutered net neutrality. This is a majorly important issue. It could have massive ramifications to open source projects and Linux, and not to mention internet freedoms. So I really recommend you go over to jupiterbroadcasting.com and listen to episode 81 of Unfilter, Neutered Net Neutrality, where we break down what the hell just happened and why it happened, who's behind it, and what's likely to change, if anything. If you haven't heard, the net neutrality rules that were passed in 2010 were struck down in the last week, thanks to a case that Verizon brought. And obviously, honestly, and we go into this in more detail in Unfilter 81, some major bonehead mistakes the FCC made back in 2010 that led to this, that essentially enabled Verizon to overturn this regulation.
The only hope I see here, and as much as I hate to root for Google, I think because Google's bread and butter depends on Verizon not being able to do stuff like this, I see some big money being tossed around at the right people.
I hope so.
I think they have to. They don't have a choice.
We go in 81 in a little more details here, but Google is actually on Google. Google was involved with a deal. People have to remember back to 2010. I know that's hard, but they were involved with a deal where initially they were going to buy some wireless spectrum, but they were faking things out. And then that got them into the negotiating position. And essentially what Google helped drive forward was a deal for the telcos where they could do any management they wanted to wireless spectrum, but they had to leave wired alone. That was the deal.
Yeah.
And now, fast forward a couple, and Google helped that push that deal forward. Now, you fast forward a couple years later, well, guess what? They've got their wireless control, anything they want to do on the wireless spectrum, and now they've also got the wired. That little wedge that Google opened for us by giving the wireless spectrum have ended up kind of backfiring in their face a couple years down the road. Not their fault, Verizon's fault, but there is an interesting, complicated history to all of this, and it really, really sucks. And it once again is showing how the U.S. is boneheadedly moving forward with our mismanagement of the internet, and eventually this is going to get taken away from the U.S., and they're going to try to move it to some sort of international body because we just keep screwing the pooch on this stuff.
Yep, that's true.
That's my personal opinion.
I think you're probably right.
Get my rant on in 81. You can go check that out. One other thing. We had a great episode this week of Linux Unplugged.
Yes.
Linux Unplugged episode 23, Google Invades Your Nest. We talked about the purchase of the Nest, which is a Linux gadget. Mm-hmm. And Chase joined Matt and I to recap some of the stuff he saw at CES, yeah, since he couldn't make it in last week's Linux Action show. And we had a good discussion there around Steam Machines as well. So go check out Linux Unplugged episode 23 for additional reading. We also announced the underdog, actually I called it the innovative little guy, where we're taking a survey of a distribution that you feel needs more attention. We've already got tons of submissions. Lots of different distros are coming in. I wouldn't really say it's landed on one that's getting more call-outs than others, but if you have a distro you feel like the Linux Action Show has never given its due attention and it's specifically innovative or interesting to you, go over to Linux Unplugged 23. You'll find the distro name, the website URL, and then you just tell us a little bit why it's that distro is great, how it surprised you and made you smile, and then submit that. And then I'll collect all those results, and eventually we'll do a review of the little guy that the community said, hey, this needs more attention. These guys are doing great work.
That's it.
So that's over in episode 23 of Linux Unplugged. Now, with all of that said, Matt, people can get a hold of this here show by going over to jupiterbroadcasting.com, clicking the contact link, and choosing Linux Action Show from the dropdown. Or even better, and you're going to want to be tuning into this more and more over the next few weeks as we approach episode 300, you can go to our subreddit over at linuxactionshow.reddit.com. Every episode, we have a discussion thread in there. Mm-hmm. Please upvote that for visibility and also put your comments in there to give us feedback for that specific episode. And last but not least, I want to invite you to join us live on Sundays at 10 a.m. Pacific. You can go to jupiterbroadcasting.com/calendar to find that in your local time zone. That's over jblive.tv. We are going to have little after-show chats with our live audience as we approach episode 300 to get ideas for just adjustments, format changes, new things we can do with the show as we hit 300. It's a good time to kind of take a look of where we're at and where we could go after post-episode 300. And over the next couple of weeks, this is we're on episode 296 today. Mm-hmm. So over the next couple of weeks as we approach 300, we'll be having a post-show chat with our live chat room as we pick our title and things like that. So I'd like to invite you to join us live for either Linux Unplugged or Linux Action Show if you would like to be involved in that conversation. Threads in the subreddit are also welcome, but sometimes there's a little extra value to have that live interactive chat element to it. So better time than ever to join us live if you'd like to get in on that conversation.
Yeesh.
Okay, Matt, I think that's everything we have for this week.
Yep, that's it.
All right, everyone. Well, thank you so much for tuning in this week's episode of the Linux Action Show. We'll see you right back here next week.
Man.
Woo.
Like Cleopatra, 25-25.
Woo. Hi, everybody. Hi there. Hi. Okay, here we go. Linux Action Show. And this, I guess I see what you're saying about the whole Skynet aspect of home automation.
Yeah, right. But at the same time, it's really cool.
Well, I just don't think it's possible. I think you got too many different companies who will never agree and want to own everything. You'll have your Samsungs who want to own your TVs, your ovens, and your smartphones and fridge, and it's all going to work with Samsung apps. And then you're going to – and they'll have – some sort of tepid, like, open protocol.
Here's how it'll happen, and I think it will. And it won't happen, but it will happen with somebody like, and I'm going to probably just go out on a limb and say Google. Google will come out with some magic.
Well, they got the Nest
They get some protocol or whatever the hell it is that it's like, it's so beneficial for them to start integrating it in these devices that it's like, they don't even have to be responsible for it. All they got to do is add the damn chip and they walk away. And these guys are like, oh, and we get some benefit and we sell more devices. Yeah, we're cool with that, whatever.
Yeah.
Google manages the hassle, blah, blah, blah. It's like Adobe and Flash, you know, when they did that for Linux. It's the same thing. I think that could happen because if it does happen that way, then, you know, literally you wake up in the morning and you feel like you're being tickled. And no, don't worry. It's just Google indexing you. It's
Maybe. You know? I think Google's going to be lucky if it works out so that all these things working up. Google, the only way Google could make that work is if Google buys every home automation appliance and just rebrands them as Google appliances. Because I think all of these guys want their own fiefdoms. They all want their own empires. And
I think it depends. I think if they kind of took that approach like Google did with Android, where it's like you can totally do whatever the hell you want with this, but here's some value added where we're not getting in your grill,
right?
But you know, it's totally your thing. Like, you do what you need to.
Here's
do.
A home automation operating system.
Yeah. It's like you know, I see what you did there, but let's kick that up a notch. Let me throw this your way. It doesn't cost you
that
nothing.
That would make sense.
Yeah.
All right, here we go. All right, stand by. We are gonna do the photography segment in a three. And a two. Last second to suck down some precious caffeine.
And snort and sniffle.
Yay! Are you going to watch some sports ball today, Matt?
Sports ball? No, I'm probably going to watch some. I'm going to catch. I got two episodes. I have an Archer allowance. I get two episodes.
Oh, dude.
On weekends, because otherwise I'll piss through them, and then I will fill the rest of the day with some robot chicken and whatever crap I can find.
Instagram.com/JupiterBroadcasting.
I used to call them Instacash, especially after they got bought out.
Yeah. Well, you know what I like about this is it's not a bunch of people like posting about how incredible their lives are.
Right,
it's just people taking good pictures.
Or memes.
Yeah. So we have Instagram.com/JupiterBroadcasting, where right now we're posting photos that people took of them wearing their new Jupiter Broadcasting swag.
You know, I took one here yesterday and put it up on Facebook.
Did you?
I need to put up in there. I did have a little facial hair at the
Flag
time.
Ange, and she'll add it to the Instagram.
Yeah, I'll have to do that.
Look, we're on GoatsLive.com. There's the Jupiter Broadcasting shirt right there on GoatsLive.com.
Cool. That's cool.
We've got drone updates.
Nice.
And I'm Filter Fan right here.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. That really is awesome. That's wow.
Yeah. That's... No, they're not all men. They're not all men. Look, there's a lady. A lady right there. Now. So far, it's mostly all men.
Yes.
Yeah, they are the only couple.
Rocking the shirt.
Yeah, they are the only couple. But it's
digging it.
See, there's a little one. Here's
server shot.
There's some good data center ones in here.
Yeah.
Our audience is so awesome.
That's cool.
Yeah. So if you guys have a new Jupiter Broadcasting shirt and you want to send it in, just email it to Angela@JupiterBroadcasting.com, or if you post it on G+ or Twitter, just make sure you flag her.
Now I know that guy.
There's Mr. Jude.
Yep. He's like, yep.
I'm going to watch a little sports ball. I don't normally watch the sports ball.
Yeah,
but
never really.
It's a big Seahawks game.
That's why I'm waiting. Usually it's like I care when Red Robin does the free burger.
Click this title for Bitcoins. That's great.
That's genius.
That's a good title.
That's evil, good title. Evil, but awesome. You get points for awesome.
Oh, chat room.
That is so evil.